Pan Arden, and if you're listening to something fabulous, well, you're listening to DJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
This is broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
Segment of our show, Lynette Louise will be telling us a little bit about her autism work. So I understand you have an extensive background with the autistic community. Could you tell me a little bit about some of the work you've done?
Are we on air already?
Recording, yes.
Okay. Hi! yeah, sure, I can tell you. It's always a difficult question to start with for me because my introduction to the autistic community or people with autism happened as a parent. So I started adopting children that were special needs, multiply handicapped, and some of them came to me with that diagnosis, some didn't, but they all came with diagnoses of some kind, and it was way back in the early 80s. So, you know, the spectrum has changed so much since then. But my introduction to it, my need to understand and make a difference began with the love of a parent and the confusion of a world that knew nothing except how to be very strict and controlling. Back then, they even, you know, had techniques like slapping and pinching and sticking your thumbs in the armpits of the kids and stuff to make them behave. So we've come a very long way. And I certainly am glad, because that was a very stressful time when they believed that it was, excuse me for coughing, when they believed that it was because of the mother not giving enough affection as opposed to all the other contributing factors that cause autism. They were just trying to point the finger at someone that they could blame and chastise. It was a tough time. But since then, I tried all of the different techniques, often felt like a really mean parent, and so then I would stop and do my own thing, fought with schools, did what schools wanted, found them lacking, tried my own way, and it went on and on like that for quite a while. I was making headway with the kids, though. They were learning and changing in a way that others weren't, and this was noticed by other parents. I started helping other parents just because that's what you do, right? So because you want to help. But at the same time, I'm educating. So I'm taking all these behavioral approaches, classes, and everything from, you know, floor time to sunrise to ABA to behavior modification, which is kind of ABA. And throughout all of that, I got lots of certifications and some degrees, and, you know, the world changed. And eventually I came up with a really beautiful cocktail of play therapy and neurofeedback, which is biofeedback for the brain. And I started equipping parents to do it at home and teaching them, and now many people do that, but it was all unheard of at the time. So I've really kind of cut my teeth on it and invented solutions. And fortunately, mostly, I'd have to say in a positive way that it's worked out. You know, my kids One is still at home. He was extremely challenged and blind when things were still, but he could see things in motion. He'd been severely abused and neglected, locked away and stuff. So he was also 4 when I got him, so his abilities are really impacted, and he's still with me. But all the other kids, out of the 8 kids I raised, everybody's independent and doing well and has their own quirky kind of life.
So
that caught you up.
So I'm curious, what was it that inspired you to want to take on what the world would have at the time considered to be one of the most difficult or least possible styles of parenting possible? What was it that made you say, these kids need our support, they deserve a real chance?
Yeah, I'm not that altruistic. It didn't happen that way. So, like many things, it's kind of a happy accident, and it started with some selfishness. I had 2 biological daughters. I had a biological son who died at birth. I wanted 2 sons to go with my 2 daughters. You know, when I do a talk, I make jokes about it, you know, bookends for balance. I wasn't really after saving the world or adopting special needs children, but adoption was a normal thing for me to choose. My father was adopted. I had an adopted brother. So thinking in terms of adoption, once I'd already had a couple of biological kids, made sense. That was a kind of a no-brainer. It was once I was in the system of adoption that I realized, first of all, I'm going to wait a very long time before I get any children, and I don't like to wait once I've made up my mind for something. Secondly, I got looking at the system more deeply. And, you know, they were showing me the kids that would get adopted, wouldn't get adopted. And I started to realize that there was this whole group of children that nobody was going to take. And then my heart started to get involved. And then I went, wow, I got to do this. But it was in part because it would be faster. I didn't see special needs as a problem. Like, I just still don't. I just see them as children who are different. I just don't get why everybody... Kids are hard anyway. All kids are hard. And they break your heart. I mean, my teenage daughters, they were biological and perfectly regular, broke my heart more than my special needs kids ever did. So, I don't know. I think I just did it because that's what came next.
So, in your time supporting these kids and learning all that you have, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's probably a million. You know, I just released, I don't know if you know this, but I have a series I put on YouTube. It used to be on the Autism Channel, but that's closed down after COVID. So I put on YouTube this series that I make called Fix It in 5, and it's where I spend 5 days working with families in various places in the world, Israel, Uganda, the States. And I just released the Israel episodes. And every time I'm working on one of these, I feel like I'm seeing nothing but miracles happen because I have the opportunity to not just do the work, but then stand back from the work and think in terms of editing and actually see what we accomplish. And I couldn't even begin to isolate for you the magical stuff. Like in Uganda, the girl went from nobody could understand her to like a little chatty Cathy in a small amount of time. But sometimes the miracle is he's not punching her in the head anymore. So it's a really big spectrum. And there are so many different presentations of this problem, not so much because autism is so varied, But because the way that the families deal with it and the educational system deals with it causes a kind of reactiveness in how that child then grows and changes, that I have to swoop in and help. And I don't know how to answer you. I mean, in my own kids, I would say that my son right now that lives with me still, that I can say to him, go downstairs and get me a bottle of water. That's a miracle, because he couldn't see like that before. He was starving because he couldn't find food that was behind a napkin. But he couldn't chew or swallow. Like, he's overweight now. That's a miracle. You know, it's a really hard question to answer. My other son that was so violent, he's a pussycat and he lives on his own. And he, you know, they had fetal alcohol syndrome, autism. I have a son who's re-upped with the National Guard. He'll have a double retirement when he comes out. He's been overseas twice. He's a helicopter mechanic. He was diagnosed with many things, including being on the spectrum. So the miracles are many. They all stand out. And I could talk a long time about them. It's a miracle because people underestimate what's possible.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, sure.
In this segment of our show, Owen O'Rourke will be sharing his memories of a soldier and a stroke survivor. So with Remembrance Day just passed, I'd imagine you were thinking about Bill Wells a lot. Stroke survivor, veteran, all-around inspiration to us all.
Oh, yeah, he's always on my mind when it comes to Remembrance Day.
Tell me a little bit about the dynamic you had growing up with a family member with a disability.
Especially when it comes to Bill Wells, I couldn't imagine having a stroke, then being told you might never be able to walk again, and then working hard to overcome that obstacle. Because what I was told, after he had his first stroke in 1982, that he would never walk again. Then he worked hard to overcome that. So something like that, I admire a lot. He didn't give up. He worked hard to keep walking.
So what do you suppose it was that kept him motivated and just with the idea that somehow, some way, he'll get his mobility back?
Well, with Bill Wells, he was always positive. He always had positive positive things to say. So I think it was more positivity that was in his mind, and he had that never give up attitude on him too. I think it just had to do with not giving up, working hard to overcome obstacles, all that.
What were some of the things that stand out about him that you remember most?
Oh, man, where do I start? I think, oh, man, his jokes, his personality, his funny sayings, going down to the pool with him every time I visited him. There's a lot of things. I can go on and on, but there's just a lot of things that stand out with him.
So, growing up, did you witness any of the rehab he underwent to get his mobility back?
So, unfortunately, I did not. When I was growing up, he was using a cane, one of those gray ones with the sticks at the bottom. So I never witnessed him go to rehab or anything like that. When I was growing up, he was using those gray canes to get around.
So, did it ever impact you recognizing that he had this strength, this determination? Did that ever affect you in a hard moment trying to get through something you didn't know if it was possible?
Yeah, there's been tons of things in my life where I thought it was going to be hard, but I think of Bill Wells, I think how hard he worked to overcome the obstacle of walking, working, you know, that, and then I think about that, and then I overcome those obstacles too. So realistically, when something I find hard, I think of Bill Wells, I think of how hard he worked to walk again. I just think that helps me overcome those obstacles as well.
Have you taken any of that to instill in your own family?
Sorry?
Have you taken any of the lessons he's given you to instill in your own family?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He always showed people respect. I try to show people respect. He's always positive to people. I try to be positive to people. So I try to take as many traits from him as I can and put them in myself so I can kind of be like the person he was.
Is there a particular memory or story, time shared with him, you'd like to share?
Oh, God, I've lost. One thing, Bill Wells taking me down to the pool room as a kid, or when I've ever come home from school, because I used to go to his house every day after school, and I remember just running up the stairs, opening his bedroom door, and he'd just be sitting there watching TV with a big smile on his face, and I miss those days. I miss him.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks. Handy Link, we'll be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Disability Studies Students Association is a small and tight-knit community of people who are passionate about and committed to representing and supporting disability studies students at the University of Windsor. The DSSA holds events on campus and in the community, like the annual Down Syndrome Day Walk, to raise funds for supporting organizations. If you would like to get involved or learn more, you can contact the Disability Studies Student Association directly at dssa@uwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from autism expert Lynette Louise, and disabilities advocate Owen O'Rourke shared his memories of growing up with a family member with a disability. Now, this next interview, folks, is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Mario Bangash will be giving us an update on SMILE. So what's the latest with SMILE?
Currently at SMILE, we are starting our December 3rd campaign, and we're fundraising as well. Our latest event will be in London, Ontario, to celebrate International Day of Persons with Disabilities, as well as in Ottawa. We have an exciting event to happen as well.
So, the International Day, can you tell me what you've got lined up for the celebration?
Yes, so in London, Ontario, we will be hosting a educational event with our leaders in the social services sector, such as like social workers, community members that work with young children with disabilities. We want to foster inclusive spaces and have candid conversations about what it means to look after our community. As well, in Ottawa, we're having an event called Pathways to Inclusion, which will be having dialogue and sharing stories from members of our community who have disabilities from the refugee and trauma-informed experience.
So, how are you reaching out to folks with disabilities to let them know about these events?
A lot of our outreach has been through email marketing and just connections that we have personally within the community, as well as through Instagram, social media outreach as well is super important.
So, I find it interesting that one of the groups you're primarily focusing on is refugees and those with trauma experience. What was the inspiration for making this a priority?
If anyone's familiar with SMILE, our priority population is refugees and migrants with disabilities who are either displaced or can't go back home to their country or had to escape their country due to war, conflict, and unsafe circumstances. So because this is our priority population and who we primarily serve, this is the community that we're highlighting.
So what are some of the ongoing programs with SMILE for those who aren't as familiar?
Currently, our ongoing programs that serve our families and our community members, on a smaller scale, we're having a winter drive this weekend to provide little care packages for our families in the Scarborough, Toronto area. As well, we've launched our inclusive lesson plan for teachers and educators in the community that want to teach about disability and making inclusive spaces. As well, like on a bigger scale for our families, our service navigation team is always working hard to ensure our families have their needs met. We often do parent coaching and support groups on and off throughout the year in different languages to make sure our families and caregivers also have the right access to support.
So, when you mentioned working with teachers, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning disabilities in this work?
Definitely, I think sometimes there can be a misunderstanding about what a disability is and how it impacts somebody, or as well, like misunderstandings about various diagnoses, but our lesson plan kind of covers that for younger children to understand what makes us different and what is a disability, and how we go about including everybody and make sure everyone feels safe and like they belong.
So do you find teachers are typically receptive and willing to learn more about disabilities in order to better serve the students that they have?
Definitely. I'd say we've had great success and luck with teachers that have gotten on board with our curriculum, and they have been super supportive and receptive to everything, and we've only gotten really positive feedback.
So, that feedback, is there any success moment or story you'd like to share where you've been able to provide especially meaningful support to a teacher who's working with kids with disabilities?
Yeah, recently, myself and a couple colleagues went to a school in Mississauga where they wanted to talk about disability inclusion as they were struggling with some acts of bullying and some ignorance, and we got to go there and sort of teach all the young children there about the importance of including everybody and making sure that they feel safe and like they belong. And you could visibly see in the room that the children were really receptive and they were really happy to have us there, and it felt like they were realizing the importance of including everybody.
So how did you gear the lesson for younger kids?
For the younger they are, the more activities we'll add, or little video clips or something like that, to make sure that they're still engaged and we're not just showing a slideshow. We'll have, like, hands-up activities or, like, moving around the room and making sure that there's some tactile input, stuff like that.
So are there any projects on the horizon for the year ahead? I mean, with 2025 about to wrap, I'd imagine that SMILE's starting to make plans for what comes next.
Definitely. I think Ramadan is really big on our radar right now, as we'll be studying much earlier this year, planning for educational events surrounding that, and inclusion within our community around, like, special times of the year around the holiday season for us. I know every year we do outreach with community members and mosques as well to make sure that their spaces are inclusive and ready to go for our important times of year as well.
So when you're an inclusive space, what are some of the key considerations that, that you look at?
I think the one that everybody will automatically think of is physical inclusivity and physical accessibility, and that is more important. Having a ramp, a wider door, a fully accessible stall with handlebars and a wider space, the floors being okay for mobility aids. But I think past that, what people forget about is thinking like on a cognitive scale or looking at it from an attitudinal perspective, I would make sure that the way you talk to somebody, the way you treat somebody, or the way that you think about them and how to bring them into your space is important to the way you approach and navigate their disability, or how you even view your disability, how they view your disability is an act of inclusion as well.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Of course. Thanks.
My friends, honestly, sometimes it just comes down to family. Being the support for someone with a disability, regardless of what the diagnosis might be, regardless of whether someone says, you'll never do this, you'll never do that, having the right people in your life can make all the difference. Being told that you'll never achieve beyond a certain point can be one of two things. It can be a great dampener on the prospects of your life, or it can be a motivator of great change. It can be the something that says, I'm not going to accept that. I'm going to work beyond. Truth is, I have yet to see a medical textbook anywhere that factors in human strength and support. And in many cases, that support comes from those we love, from our family. In Owen's story, hearing the tales of how Bill Wells fought his way back, it must have been just so uplifting for him. Coming from a place of doing the impossible, doing what no one thought you could, living with strength, but more than that, living with dignity. For someone with a disability, there is no greater gift than to live their life their way. To be out there and saying, I'm going to do this, not to spite anyone, not because someone told me I couldn't, because this is what I want to do and this is who I want to be. Men like Bill Wells lived with this dignity. They lived with this strength. They didn't do it necessarily to inspire others. They did it because there's someone living proudly with a disability. And truly, that's what we should all look to. For Lynette, taking on the responsibility of children that no one thought could have a productive future, that is an awesome responsibility, but it's also a great privilege. It's taking a chance to take that seed and see what it can grow into, the person who they can become years from now. And also, creating a curriculum, creating methods that will reach these kids. It's critical because it sets the precedent, and also it raises the bar for all of us. Because honestly, in disability life, the minimum is not good enough. We don't do things out of a sense of obligation. This is what we legally must do to support the disability community. Yeah, that's adequate. But is it really giving growth potential? Is it really helping these people reach their very best? Is it giving them an opportunity to advance in their hopes and their dreams as anyone else would? If the answer is no, then there's still a gap to be filled, my friends. But taking on that responsibility is not something that should be seen as laborious. It is something that should be seen as an opportunity to love. Because if you love someone with a disability, it does grow your heart. It changes the type of person you are. You don't look at them as being damaged or broken or whatever the first glance society might take would be. You look at them and you say, this is someone with beautiful skills and beautiful potentials. This is someone who could someday change the world. And I need to be that's someone they can fall back on when they need an extra hand. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
CJSF 90.1 FM wishes you a bright winter solstice.
And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. Simon Fraser University, the 1960s. In the earliest days of SFU, a renegade unlicensed radio station begins broadcasting around campus. 1974.